You're listening to Peaches Aren't the Only Fruit podcast, a fan podcast about the Amazon Prime series, A League of Their Own. I'm Emma. I'm here with Karen. You can find us at PATOF podcast on Twitter and Instagram. You can also find us wherever you get podcasts. You can also find me at Plateless Ordinary, Karen at Les underscore Dish. We're so excited to jump back in to discussing episodes with you. We're going to start with episode 5. And Karen, let's hit it with the 2-minute recap of what happened.
All right, I'm starting my timer now. We start off, Max has just had a horrible time. She's blown the tryout for the Screw Factory baseball team. So she and Carson are out in a field because Max wants to prove that she can pitch. But it's not working. She's off her game. Carson hits her pitch and Max storms off. Next, Max and Clance are in the Screw Factory. Neither of them are okay. Clance's husband has now gone to war and Max's life is crumbling because she doesn't have an identity outside of baseball. And it's just not working out. Meanwhile, it's not working so great for Carson either, as Carson and Lupe are yelled at. Turns out, Dove's not coming back. It's under Carson's skin because she's trying to make out with Greta, but she's worried about, can she be the coach? Can she be what these players need? Meanwhile, we talked about last time Shirley and Shirley's homophobia. Shirley's still worried about Joe being the big queer on the team. So Carson tries a new tack and tells Shirley that, in fact, the reason Dove left is because Joe and Dove were dating. Meanwhile, trouble at home for Max. As everything continues to crumble, she gets in a fight with Tony. Max, so immature, melting down. She goes to see Clance. They both admit they're not fine. Carson's still trying to make it work with Max. Let's play catch. And this starts this friendship between them when they go out into the field at night normally and just throw a ball around. Meanwhile, Max, in response to this tension with her mom, finds her Aunt Bertie, now Bert's, address and goes to pay him a visit. Bert, a trans man in the 1940s, is an entirely new character that we meet. And meanwhile, the Peaches, things are going poorly. Carson's having trouble wrangling the cats, and Bev doesn't help by telling Carson that she needs to exert more control. Lupe, not happy with it. Greta and Joe talking about can they actually live full lives and be happy. And finally, the Peaches win.
I feel like a lot happened.
And there were a few things I left out, but you know what? We're going to talk about them as we go through this episode.
I think you hit the high points. I think a lot happened in this episode, but at the same time, in some ways, it felt like it didn't move the plot forward as much. I enjoyed seeing some relationships develop, but at the same time, I sort of wish we had seen some things be more explained in it. And frankly, some of the things in this episode, I wish we'd been introduced to earlier in the series. So let me ask, what was your overall take of this episode?
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting thing because this is a very Max-centric episode. Even as it moves forward, the idea of Carson as coach, the Peaches finally coming together and coming into their own. But it's all about Max. But we talked about one of the problems with Max as a character is that she never seems to mature. And I think that's one of the problems within this episode because we've just passed the midway point and we need to see a change starting in Max. And while we start to see some change, and we're going to talk about this, whether she's showing agency, I think there's still this problem of Max really still not having any identity outside of baseball. Like, Emma, if I asked you, what do you think Max does for fun that's not baseball?
I know. I hadn't thought about that until you pointed it out. We'd talked before we were recording, and you mentioned that offhandedly. And I was like, yeah, I mean, she's friends with Clance. She spends time with her family, but she doesn't seem to have a lot of hobbies and also like more expansive hobbies. For example, even though Clance, we know she's really big into comics and illustration, you can sort of imagine that that expands to other things. Like maybe she's artistic. We also know that she's got her family, that she's into her new marriage, and there are things that she seems to be concerned with outside of just a hobby. But Max does seem so singularly focused on one thing in a way that's a little bit unrealistic. Even if that's her one love, it's her true love. I wish that we saw more about her as a character, a more well-rounded, robust picture of her as a person.
I think that is the problem when you have an ensemble cast, is you have such limited time to dedicate to each character. But as you point out, There's a lot going on with Clance, not just the comic books and the husband, but we have this idea of wanting to please the in-laws, coming to work at the factory, all of these things that create a much more well-rounded character. Whereas with Max, even the efforts to provide rounding, because they're still grounded in baseball, I mean, how old is Max? What is her educational background? What has she been doing? Is she just sweeping the beauty salon all day before the screw factory thing opened up? There's just a black hole here that because she doesn't have any friends other than Clance, we don't have an opportunity to see her interact with other people and provide faceting other than Gary, which as we know is still centered in baseball.
Yeah, and like you point out, she joins the team because she wants to pursue baseball. It's a means to an end for her, and making the extra salary is really nice. But yeah, I really started to think in this episode that I wish we got, frankly, if they were going to do an episode around Max, I wish that we got a full episode around Max, where it was really Max telling the story, instead of just kind of watching what happens to Max in many ways. That being said, there were some things I want to mention that I loved about this episode. So to me, the overall theme was Max and Carson having reckonings about who they are. And part of the way that that was explored was seeing their friendships. Some of the scenes between Max and Clance, I just found to be hilarious and heartwarming. Greta and Joe having a very important moment, showing their friendship and discussing their history, which I think turned out to be kind of a turning point for Greta in that she was able to then show vulnerability to Carson. And I thought that that was really great to see the Greta-Joe friendship explored. Also, some of the more nascent relationships developing between Jess and Lupe, we saw a continuation of that, as well as, of course, Gretzen. Again, the vulnerability that Greta shows as she's moving forward in her relationship with Carson. And then a little bit about Max and Carson, but I want to put a pin in that and talk about it later because the Max and Carson relationship, something felt off about it to me in this episode.
Okay, not to me, but let's kind of break those things down. So let's talk about the first thing you mentioned, Max and Carson coming into their own. I mean, that's really what this episode is about, right? So let's start with Max. One of the things that I noticed here is we have now kind of two figures that represent alternate paths that Max could take. We have Toni, who represents heteronormativity. She represents a stable job. She represents the life that Max lived before. And then we have Bert, and Bert represents queerness. Bert represents going outside of social norms, and Bert represents following your dreams. And one of the things that I noticed is first Max goes to Toni, and she's kind of following that. She says, I'm giving up baseball. I'm going to do what you say. Why don't you cut my hair? But at the end of the episode, she goes to Bert and says, Bert, will you cut my hair?
In between that, though, which I noticed especially on my rewatch, was Max has Toni do her hair up really nice. And then Max goes and has her ill-fated, but what I found to be pretty funny, intimate moment. I appreciated that they had a sex scene for her in which she had agency. She wasn't victimized, but it's so clear in that. And her face, I mean, I thought the actor's acting and expressions were hilarious because it's so clear that she's like, no, I'm not this path that is my mom's path of getting dolled up, of having a future husband. That's not in the cards for me. And she seems to be kind of just sure, like, okay, I tested this out and it's not for me. And then you're right. At the end of the episode, she shows up at Bert's home and she says, okay, you know what? Put me into the mold that you're in. But as you pointed out earlier, it feels like Max is sort of going back and forth that she can't figure out who she is as a person.
Yeah, I think that part's a little bit hard because we have this symbolism, but because Max has that immaturity, it is weird that it's like within the same episode, it's kind of whiplash. Maybe if that particular thing had been spread between two episodes. I love that scene with Gary. I think you're right. I think Shantae Adams did a fantastic job and it's a great scene and not one that I've necessarily seen. I can't think of any other examples on TV, maybe in a movie. It's just uncommon, and I think it really shows what Max is going through and what other queer women have gone through as they question their own orientation and stuff. But yeah, I think that having that vacillation does reinforce this sense of Max not being well grounded and kind of being carried by the wind.
I think you're right. I think if it had been split up in multiple episodes, I also wish that we had met Bert earlier, but I get that they're putting it for the second half of the show. I think maybe if we'd seen more with Max at the first half, you know, the first half of the series, where she was trying to fit in with Tony's mold, and then they could have had a more easy, gradual transition to meeting Bert, and then have the second half being more exploration of living in the world, potentially, as a queer person.
By the way, I thought it was very hurtful. I as the viewer, was hurt when Max just fled the home when she saw Bert. And I don't know, couldn't she have just like made up an excuse? I mean, again, it goes back with that idea of immaturity. If you're mature, then you find some excuse. If you're uncomfortable, you leave. You don't just flee that way.
I really like that, though, because I felt like it showed her shock. And especially in the show where it seems sometimes like it's not sure if the show is giving a historical commentary and being serious about issues, or if the show is using the modern lens. I mean, it definitely is using a modern lens, but how much it's using a modern lens. I felt like Max doing that actually showed just her being like, WTF, what is going on? As weird as it was, just that whole, like, she's shutting down. And I think maybe it would have been better if they'd had something more for her explaining that. And I don't know if it would have been, like, if she had diary or some sort of outlet to explain what's going on in her head. Because we do get to see that with Carson and the relationships that she has. But with Max, it's really all up there in her head. She's not talking to Clance about it. When she was having a relationship earlier in the series, she wasn't talking to someone about, oh, what are you thinking about figuring out who you are? So that might have been a little bit of disconnect too.
Yeah, I get your point. In the 1940s, if it turned out your aunt is now living as a man, I think you would probably be pretty surprised. Let's move on to Carson. So Carson in this episode, this is kind of Carson going from being meek and getting walked all over to attempting to be someone else's version of what strong is, to trying to find her own strength and trying to find her own position of authority and leadership style.
That part I thought was really compelling. And I think that's such a common experience for people, especially for women who are told, well, you need to step up and do something. And especially when Carson's instructed, act like a man and be tough, that Carson doesn't have clearly role models for how to be a leader and how to be strong as a woman. So I like that continuation of her arc. And definitely there were some funny moments where she's trying to be tough and no one takes her seriously. And I thought that was great to add humor to it.
I think it's interesting too, because Bev can cow the other women. Bev, in essence, inherently embodies leadership through her physical presence. But Carson doesn't have that. So when Bev is like, you know, put on your grr face and Carson tries, it becomes comedic instead. And I think one of the things when we talk about what makes a good leader, what makes a good boss or whatever, those two things, by the way, not being synonymous, there is the idea of, can they establish trust? Can they build rapport? There's a difference between someone who can cow you into submission and someone you want to follow. In this case, Carson ends up establishing that bond really quickly by admitting her own vulnerability, by admitting that she doesn't have all the answers. Was it a little bit forced? Sure, a little bit. It's always difficult when one of your direct teammates suddenly becomes the equivalent of your boss.
I was going to say, have you ever had that either in a sports team or a work situation where somebody who was your peer and someone who you palled around with, all of a sudden they're the person in charge and they make decisions? Because I thought a lot of things about seeing the Peaches do that seemed really true to life.
Yeah, I've had that happen a few times. I think it's very difficult on both sides because you go from having the equivalent of a friendship to a relationship that's more hierarchical. For me, what I require is, in essence, you have to show that I should respect you. If you're just my friend and I think I could do your job better, it's not going to work. And that's kind of the tension that existed between Carson and Lupe when Lupe is like, I can do this job better. You have to show that there's something that differentiates you. Why are you in that position? And I think Carson had already established some of her bona fides, right? She had been studying other people's plays. She understood the team's abilities. And I think she just really needed to reinforce that and remind people, this is why I'm in this position. This is why Greta nominated me and others signed on to that.
Although I'm not totally convinced, as much as I love the arc, that Carson is the best leader. And I think that speaks a little bit to some of the dynamics we saw between Carson and Lupe in this episode that I want to get into. This episode, I really started to feel sympathy for Lupe. Especially on my rewatch, I really liked her more and more and was so interested to see her as a character. But there was a scene that she has with Jess where she makes it clear that she feels like she's intentionally been left out of things and denied opportunities because of her ethnicity and her background. She at times seems like a character who can be difficult. She isn't the best at integrating with a team. She's trying to do things to show her leadership and be commanding. But the more we learn about her, the more I understand why that is. And the fact that she probably has been in many situations before where she's felt passed over and like she has to project strength in a certain way because people are going to make the wrong kinds of assumptions about her. Not from anything that she's done, but just because of who she is.
This episode has a lot of really powerful moments, but on that rewatch, what Lupe said hit just so hard. And like you said, it made me wish that we had seen so much more of Lupe, because what she is saying isn't just microaggressions. They're what to her seem to be macroaggressions. Hey, you all went off and played, and you didn't bring me. One of the women of color, one of the like two women of color, because Esty is the other one. If we get into a fight, I'm the one blamed. And it's all of these things where she's opening Jess's eyes, but opening the eyes of the viewer to the fact that there are these things that women of color deal with, that people of privilege, that lens isn't there to even have that interpretation. And I thought that was just amazing, because later, Max also says a similar thing to Carson.
Mm-hmm.
We talked in a previous episode about the overt racism at the Screw Factory or at the butcher shop, but these were so much more powerful. You can dismiss the overt racism and say, oh, well, no one's going to deny you a job at the Screw Factory during wartime anymore because you're a person of color. But it's the other things. It's the unconscious blame, the unconscious biases that come into play, the blindness of privilege.
Yeah.
More of that, I really think the show could have leaned into. Because I think that was a strength there.
Absolutely. And that part you mentioned with Max in this episode was when Max and Carson had been throwing a ball together. And Carson says, oh, it would be great to have you on the team. You know, I could talk to you so much better than my pitcher. And Max is taken aback. And she's kind of like, better for whom? For you, Carson? And Max points out that Carson didn't say anything when Max was dismissed from tryouts. I want to use this to talk a little bit about Carson as a character and her background. And again, the show using a modern lens, but I think at times doing a little bit of a disservice because we see so much of that big racism in so many episodes, and things like this can be powerful. The show has great social commentary, but we're not really looking at Carson critically. I mean, here in this episode, we do a little bit. But she's very often shown to be accepting of different people. And I think it's unlikely, frankly, that a woman with her background and her social status would not have prejudices at this time. And my concern is that if we see ourselves in Carson, which I think a lot of fans do, we might think that we're always on the right side of things, rather than questioning and examining our own unconscious biases. So I want to talk a little bit about Carson and what her situation probably would have been like. And we've gotten into this before, discussing how white women at this time, a married white woman probably was not working, whereas her black counterparts would have been more likely to still be in the workforce because of wage disparities. You know, they make jokes, and I know you love this joke about Carson not being from a farm, but she is supposed to be from Idaho. I did a little bit of research. Black people were never more than 0.3% of the population of Idaho. In 1940, this was less than 600 people. There was an article that I pulled up from 1990 in which someone who had been doing a historical look at the state mentioned that white residents generally didn't believe racism was a problem, But many Black residents recounted incident after incident that made them aware of the color of their skin. So 0.3% of Idaho being Black compared to about 10% of the U.S. population in 1940, according to census data. In more modern times, about 0.1% of Idaho is Jewish. About 13% of the state is Latino, compared to about 19% of the U.S. population. These are mostly Mexican Americans, according to census data. The initial growth was in the early 1990s when many people, particularly men, came to work as laborers in fields and on railroads. During World War II, there was even a program that brought Mexican citizens to fill a labor need. But it was stopped in the 1940s in Idaho, in part because of discrimination, poor housing, and harsh work. Again, just thinking about this context, someone like Carson has probably grown up in a bubble in which everyone is like her. Everyone probably is white, of a certain class, married, goes to the same type of church. That doesn't mean that someone from that background is inherently racist or doesn't have an open heart to other people. But I think, as many people have experienced, when you're not familiar with other types of people, you probably do have some sort of unconscious bias. You don't know about other types of people. And so depicting Carson as just openly accepting everybody, as much as I love it for her as a character, again, I go back to, would it have been realistic? And do we maybe all need to stop and think about, like, are there times when we haven't grown up with certain types of people and we don't know about them and we hold prejudices that we don't mean poorly or we don't have bad intention, but they are still there?
Or even, Emma, another way to frame that is sometimes when you end up in a group of people that are not your ethnic group or whatever, it doesn't matter if you're not prejudiced. You might immediately feel uncomfortable. I was just thinking as you were talking about that, when you and I went dancing and we ended up in DC at an Asian club. And I think you and I were like the only white people in that club. And let me tell you, it felt awkward. Not for any reason, not because anyone was racist or anything like that. It's just when you find yourself in a situation when you're surrounded by people you normally aren't, there's an immediate sense of, whoa, difference, right? And so when Carson walks onto the factory line at the screw factory, and this is a completely Black shift, I don't care about her conversation pie. She should have slowed her walking at least a little bit and realized, I shouldn't be here. I don't belong here. And the people would have looked at her and been like, what is this white lady doing here? As Clance does, right? Clance is the person that's like, what are you doing? Again, it has nothing to do with racism, but that feeling of difference.
Yeah, absolutely. When you're not used to being in a certain situation. Also, again, going back to Carson probably didn't work. We have no indication of that. So walking into the factory where, you're right, it's mostly Black workers at this time. She's not used to being in that sort of space. I mean, that would probably be weird for anybody. Frankly, if you put me in a screw factory today where I am not used to working, I probably would just be like, oh, I'm a little nervous. Am I going to get hit by, you know, people are wearing like welder's masks and stuff. Do I need a hard hat in this type of situation? In this episode, I wanted to mention something else kind of related to this. Again, we've discussed Shirley before. There's one line that Shirley mentions here about being concerned about Joe's queerness. And Shirley says, what you ignore always kills you. It just, again, seemed weird when we know that the Holocaust is going on at this time. And that's an example of sometimes the show talks a lot about existing context. And sometimes it's like, oh, we're just not acknowledging that maybe somebody else is having an anxiety about something. Sort of like how we just got to Lupe feeling a certain way, feeling concerned and feeling disheartened because of the experiences that she's living through. They're very different characters, but just sometimes the show doesn't always paint that rich picture. You know, Karen, I think part of this is that there are so many great actors on the show. I really think that there's such great writing. There are great performances that really, they crack me up. They make me feel emotional, pulling my heartstrings. But I think some of it might be that the writing is not built to encompass so many people's stories. And I thought in this episode about Broad City, which I discussed at the beginning, a show I really like by Abby Jacobson. And I think a strength of that show was that it focused really on the friendship of two people. And then they had a supporting cast, including people who were featured in multiple episodes, or it would be a single episode focusing on somebody's story. But when you have each episode trying to weave together the lives of a dozen people at times, I mean, that's very complicated to do in a short period of time. So I think that's something where hopefully if and when there's a second season, they can change the pacing and maybe adjust it a little bit so that everybody gets their fair shot to have their story explored with the sort of care that it deserves.
Yeah, that is one of the problems with the shift with the streaming services to go towards 6 or 8 episodes per season. It's more in line with what the British do, and it enables a tighter pacing. It enables more focus on the storyline and whatnot. But it takes away from the stories about the people. There's just not the space to talk about all of these characters.
And I think it's a shame because I feel like for this show, what people love about it is the people. People love the Gretzen. They love seeing those relationships.
I'm not watching it for the baseball. Honestly, I don't care. I don't even remember baseball rules anymore.
And as we talked about, the baseball thing has been done. It's great, but we're watching it for the people and being able to tell all those stories. Like I said, I think in this episode, seeing some of that vulnerability that Greta has with Carson was great. And a lot of that, I feel like, was linked to Greta's conversation with Joe. So do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. We've talked in the past about how we always wish there was more of the Greta-Joe relationship, and that does come into play more in the second half of the season. This talk that they have in this episode is the first time we get a little bit more of that backstory, this idea that they've created these rules to keep them safe, but those rules also mean they're constantly in motion, they can't establish relationships with people, whatnot, and Joe's tired of it. She says, the world is changing, let's, if not settle down, at least relax the rules a little bit and enjoy what's there. I think that's wonderful, and it really does lead into, as you said, that moment later in the episode when Greta opens up to Carson and says, I loved someone, and it ended so poorly, and I'm terrified that same thing is going to happen to you. It's not, I'm protecting myself, it's, I'm trying to protect you.
And I actually love Joe as a character. Especially in my rewatch, I wanted to learn so much more about her because I love seeing how she's there and protective of Greta, wants Greta to succeed. But then I'm sure that Joe has her own inner life. And I was like, tell me more about Joe. What's Joe been through? Because you can tell that she's seen things too. This is a point I want to mention about the casting too. Again, with that issue of, is this kind of a reality thing? Is it sort of, as I initially imagined, like a semi-dream sequence from Broad City? Because I was looking at the roster of the players who were on the team, and most of the women were in their early 20s to mid-late 20s. In this show, the actors tend to skew older. And that a little bit, I think, raises a question of talking about when you had, like Greta talks about a romance when she was 17, but in real life now, the actor is like 40. It felt a little bit like a disconnect if we're trying to take this again as serious social commentary, or is this meant to be a little bit campy? I think if they'd made it a little more campy and turned up, you kind of wouldn't think about, oh, is that a weird thing for age-wise?
You know, it doesn't bother me, but the reason it doesn't bother me is because now I'm an older millennial, if you will, and I want more TV about people my age. You know, I don't know how old the Peaches were at the time that they played. Like you, I pulled up the Peaches, and for anyone that hasn't looked, the pages for the Peaches, for the other players in the league, are extensively documented. It's really interesting. And also for anyone that didn't think there were any queer women in the league, like at least 75% of them. I mean, you just look at the photos and you're like, that one was gay and that one was gay and that one was gay. So absolutely fascinating.
By the way, and like the Wikipedia entry for some of them, it's like, she never married. And it's like, I have some ideas about that.
Right. She retired to Florida and probably had a wife and a cat. It's just not on the Wikipedia page.
She never married, but she lived with a friend for 50 years, and they were buried in matching plots, and they wore matching necklaces.
I'm laugh crying right now.
I mean, some of this is like, okay, guys, we know. Again, and all those people who were like, How can they be putting the wokeness into the show? It's like, no, this was actually real. This absolutely was part of it.
Huge part. So I want to step back just for a moment, just to take up something that, I mean, we didn't gloss over it, but worth coming back to. Carson and Max, they have this talk about sex with men because Max has now had sex with Gary and it was absolutely terrible. And Max says, how could you? And Carson's like, well, I know, blah, blah, blah. And Max is like, no, physically, how did you have sex with a man and not throw up? I actually love this scene. It's one of my favorite scenes in the episode because we have this very clear delineation of like, yep, had sex with a dude, definitely never want to do it again. And then we have Carson, who's like, I love Charlie, but I love Greta as well. And sex with a man isn't the worst thing that's ever happened to me. We've talked about whether Carson is bisexual, whether she is lesbian but doesn't mind sex with men. It doesn't have to be a definitive answer. To me, I think this is yet another example of pointing out Carson's bisexuality. But I think it's a really nice talk. If you're a heterosexual viewer and you're like, how would a person know that they're lesbian? Well, the answer is because they had sex with a dude and they hated it.
And I think that for people who've never thought about having those sorts of conversations during a coming of age, you know, for many people, again, going back to when you're in the in-group, when you're around people who are just like you, I think for people who are used to being in out-group type scenarios, you have more conversations about, well, hey, this thing is different about me than other people. And like, I'm looking around like, wait, are you guys also know that this thing is different about you too? And realizing, okay, yeah, that's just how it is. And that's fine.
And it's a difficult conversation to broach because we get the sense that she's never told Clance about this. So this is probably the first person Max has ever told. And it's one of those things where if you lived in basically any period before like the 1950s, yeah, how would you find other people like you? How do you broach that conversation? It's a risk to bring that up to someone. Max knows she can with Carson because she's seen Carson kissing Greta.
Mm-hmm.
And so having that conversation with someone else, that's so powerful in that moment to be able to have that dialogue. Because who else are you going to have it with?
And I think it's something that we, I don't want to say take for granted, but I feel like especially for us as older millennials, remembering even when things were different in the 90s and like when it was much more of a big deal for celebrities to come out. I mean, it still can be today, but when it really was a big deal of like potentially career ending or people stop following your music or your movies before the internet, when you wouldn't know how to connect with people. And even, you know, my hope is with our podcast that someone listening to this is like, hey, yeah, that's cool that other people are thinking and talking about these issues, this show. And I'm not alone out there. And, you know, be it the other groups that exist, the fan clubs online, it's exciting to see people openly have fandoms instead of just sitting at home being like, am I the only person who's ever like considered that I'm not quote unquote normal or I'm different than other people?
And that leads us into Bert, because we're now used to seeing queer female characters in historical pieces. We get them all the time. Not so much with trans characters, and definitely not female to male trans characters. So it's great that they brought Bert in and were like, you know what? These people were around in the 1940s as well. It wasn't just queer women. Trans people have always been around. And look, here's someone who represents queer joy with the trans experience. He's got a wife. He's got a house. He's doing great for himself.
See, that too is where I wish that the show could have even been more campy, because it's like, I want Bert to be living his best life. I had questions about, wait, so he just came back to Max's hometown and people know where to find him and stuff, even though he's kind of been run out and abandoned. I want to see him doing his thing, but it seems like he's so sort of openly about it. And I'm not quite sure, especially back in your hometown where people know you, they know your name, whether that would have been the case.
Okay, Emma, as we hit the end of the episode, it's time for the lightning round. So first question for you, who's got your favorite hairstyle?
Okay, this has to be Gracie, Bert's wife. Bert was looking very sharp, but Gracie, when we first met her at the factory, obviously Max and Clance were in awe. And I agree, she looked beautiful. Really props. I mean, I would assume, as Bert mentioned, that he also learned to hairstyle along with Tony. Maybe Bert is behind that. Yeah, props to Gracie.
Yeah, you know what? When we first meet Gracie, it's really interesting because the way the camera focuses on her, the lighting, we know she's going to be someone important. And when we first met her, I thought she was going to be Max's love interest. That's what I was getting from that setup.
I felt like she seemed like someone older who was more sophisticated, and that's why it made sense to me, but I see where you're coming from.
Okay, next question. What's something you would have changed about the episode?
Okay, I want to say something I would have changed would have been something I wanted to see more of, which was when Max and Clance go and eat the guys' lunches. I thought that was hilarious, and like I've been saying in this episode, in terms of punching it up and making it sort of not realistic, over the top, I would have loved to see more of that. I would have loved to see more hijinks like that when it's such a Max-focused episode, because that's where I think the two of them shine, doing things that you're like, okay, in real life, probably no one's going to do that, but I just thought it was so funny. And so, yes, just seeing more of them together and doing those sorts of fun things, I think would have, I don't know, just made it a funny episode, made it even funnier. It was a funny episode, but punching it up more.
Yeah, it's interesting that you choose that one, because even though I liked the crab hunt and loved that slapstick, I did not love the eating the lunch bit.
Why didn't you like it?
I didn't like it because it just felt so immature and dangerous. Can you imagine if they'd been caught?
Yeah, but I don't think it was really happening. That's the thing. I mean, I don't think this would have happened in real life. I think it's one of those taking the liberties of television so that you can see something that is what you wish you could do. If you were being immature, if you were giving into that little devil on your shoulder.
I don't know. I guess I don't have a devil on my shoulder. Okay, final question. It's the same one we ask every time. Who was your favorite character of the episode?
My favorite character, I'm going to pick two characters. I'm actually going to say Tony and Bert, because I saw how Tony and Bert both have so much love for Max. I felt like you could see how they're both people with good hearts who are so proud of her in their own ways. And even though Tony can be harsh on Max and Bert hasn't seen Max in so long, I felt like the actors really showed the love that's there. And in terms of Max's story, I feel like those elders in her family really round out what her story is about. And as we discuss, showing these two potential paths that are set out for Max as she finds her own way. So yeah, Tony and Bert, I thought they were standout in this episode.
I agree. I really liked Tony in this episode. I love you. That doesn't mean I have to like you.
I think as I get older, for sure, I understand more of that. And we've talked about this before, of when you're younger and you are like, why are my parents doing these things? Or older people, parental figures, teachers, etc. in your life. But I really could see in this episode how Tony cares so much for Max and will always love Max. And frankly, I think that Tony will also always love Bert, and that Tony's hurt and some of Tony's actions are coming from a place of feeling worried for Bert rather than a hate for Bert.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that wraps up today's podcast episode talking about episode 5 of A League of Their Own. And again, still waiting on renewal news. Definitely scared. The odds are not looking good right now.
But you know, Darcy and Abby keep making appearances places too, talking about the show.
All right. You be hopeful. You be optimistic. I'll be a little more pessimistic. The glass is half full and we have no idea what that means. So catch us next time on Peaches Aren't the Only Fruit podcast. We hope you have a fantastic week and that you come talk to us on our social media at PAOTF podcast on Twitter.
Nope.
Nope.
PATOF.
PATOF.
Peaches Aren't the Only Fruit.
Peaches Aren't the Only Fruit podcast. PAOTF.
No.
I don't know. Find us.
PATOF
podcast on Twitter.
On Tumblr, it is podcast in progress. That's the handle.
I love that. That's wonderful. I can't believe we filched that one. No one claimed it yet. All right. So come find us. Come talk to us. We're friendly. We'll talk back in a good way.